And indeed, we have counsel only for appellant who is arguing today. A respondent, a pro se respondent, did file an informal letter indicating that he would not wish to take part. I think this letter, in effect, asked the court to follow the district court's ruling. We issue the matters as a point of law in this case, following Ms. Sandstead's arguments for appellant. Welcome to the Court of Appeals. I'm joined by Judges Johnson and Hooten. This is the third of three oral matters we are proceeding on today. This is file A21292. Cody Lee Elvin is the respondent, at least in this matter, versus St. Louis County appellant. And counsel, you will, per usual, have 15 minutes for argument. Since there's no counsel arguing on the other side, I suspect you won't have to rebut yourself. And so we'll conclude after 15 minutes. If at any time we run into any technological issues, of course, we will freeze the clock until we get you back and moving. I'll just note for the record, too, that no reproduction recording of any type of this proceeding is allowed by court rules, but we will be all heard again if you go on the court's website within 24 hours. So with that, Ms. Sandstead, you may identify yourself for the record and proceed, please.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Nora Sandstead. I'm here on behalf of Appellant St. Louis County in this matter. Given that there has not been a responsive brief filed, I will keep my comments short this morning. This is an appeal from the decision of the trial court that denied St. Louis County's motion for summary judgment, determining that St. Louis County was not entitled to immunity from the $15,000 claim asserted by respondent Cody Elvin. The county appealed that order, denying summary judgment on two immunity issues that we believe the trial court got wrong. First, vicarious official immunity, and second, with regard to statutory discretionary immunity. Both of those related to the county's decision-making around the security at the county impound lot. With regard to vicarious official immunity, it's a fairly straightforward error here. The trial court succinctly denied vicarious immunity to the county on the basis that there were no individual defendants involved in the case. And that is clearly contradictory to the established law in the Anderson and Schroeder cases that we cite in our brief. We'd ask the court, Judge Hooten, I think you're on mute if you're trying to ask.
Yeah, I'm surprised you knew I was speaking. But in any event, I mean, don't we first have to look at the statute under which this action is being brought, which is 609.531 subdivision 5.
So, Your Honor, this is not a forfeiture claim. This is a small claims action for damages that is distantly related to a forfeiture action.
But doesn't that statute, that's the statute that the court referenced when the court issued the decision, correct? And that statute requires that property seized as part of a forfeiture, which this vehicle was seized as part of a forfeiture, right?
So the claim for damages here is not for the vehicle. The vehicle was subject to several other cases.
I understand that, but the apparently there are a lot of things in that vehicle.
Yeah.
And the statute requires the appropriate agency shall use reasonable diligence to secure the property and prevent waste. So this is a statutory requirement that would apply, wouldn't it? Would it not, to that property and that car?
Yes, Your Honor. And we addressed that argument in earlier hearings on this matter. And so our argument with regard to the securing of the property, in our paperwork on the requesting the motion for summary judgment, we argued that the actions taken to secure the vehicle when it was brought into the impound lot and the security ongoing generally at the impound lot was sufficient to satisfy that statutory requirement that we take reasonable actions to secure the property.
Well, I mean, but the court held in response to your summary judgment motion that there's an issue of fact here as to whether you did take reasonable efforts or not. At least there's an issue of fact. Am I correct?
Well, that is what the court ruled on the that particular issue.
Well, and I guess I'm leading up to a question, because in that we have a statute that requires requires that when property is seized like this, the appropriate agency, which which I don't think there's a dispute, your client is the appropriate agency, shall use reasonable diligence to secure the property and prevent waste. So that was a statutory duty they had. So by reasonable diligence, that necessarily involves issues of, I think that would be akin to negligence, correct? So that's what's required by statute, aren't your arguments regarding an official immunity kind of moot here? Because it would basically eviscerate this whole statute, which says you've got this duty and you've got to do it, and you've got to do it reasonably.
I see what you're getting at, Your Honor. And the issue is that the trial court narrowed the question of that reasonable diligence to the issue of initially securing the vehicle, but then looked later at the questions, the incidents of what happened between the break-ins of the impound lot in deciding the immunity questions. And so this has been an issue throughout this this case and the cases that preceded it by Mr. Elvin, is what is the conduct and who is the actor that he is particularly saying was in error. And in fact, my recollection of the hearing, the summary judgment hearing, is that we moved away from the question of the security at the impound lot. And I believe that the order from the trial court, let me find this here. On page 7 of our addendum, the court says that we're talking about statutory discretionary immunity because of the choices made in planning, budgeting for, and constructing the impound lot. But the court's take on the claim is that it's not related to the construction, but rather what the county did to secure his property once it was known the break-ins were occurring. And so if that is the issue, which I believe is, given that's the trial court's decision and there hasn't been any contradiction from the respondent as to that being the narrow issue of his claim, then the decision needs to be whether or not those choices made after the first break-in are subject to protection of vicarious official immunity and statutory official immunity.
Well, and again, it seems, I guess it's what actions do we call discretionary and what actions are non-discretionary? I mean, here, the statute has said the property has to be secured. The property and reasonable diligence has to be exercised in order to assure that. So that discretionary decision as to whether, who's got the responsibility for that property and what has to be done with that property has already been decided by the legislature, correct?
In terms of the initial securing of the property, I believe that is correct. I think that there's...
And so all these other actions, aren't they just basically... an operational function? What did you do or not do to comply with that statute?
And so from there, I think the facts, given that the you had this intervening action of the break into the impound lot, the acts of the county in response to that, to add patrols, to add a camera, to enhance the security, those decisions were discretionary planning level decisions. They required the department to analyze what they had in the budget, what the risk was, looking at how to enhance protections for that lot. And so those were
on that issue. Level. On that issue, I mean, what is the evidence in the record that somebody on a, I mean, these are these policymaking activities, I think, are often done at the higher levels of the organization, perhaps by, if not elected office holders, you know, the senior members of staff. So, I mean, is there any evidence that somebody who worked for the county in a different location was engaging in some activity to make planning level decisions after the first break-in?
So I don't think that there's anything in the record regarding the structure of the Sheriff's Department and who at what level was making those decisions. Lieutenant Nate Skelton is a supervisor within the department and oversees the running of the impound lot.
And I don't, and of course, I don't mean to diminish his position at all, but it seems like he being the person who, I get the sense he worked at the impound lot. That was his work site, his location.
No, he worked in the Virginia office, and this was one of his, oversight of the impound lot is one of his many responsibilities. It's not.
I see. So
he's
so
not the impound lot guy.
So if he was making, if he was doing the planning, who was responsible for executing on those plans?
The people he was supervising. So everyone on his team, he, in terms of adding patrols, he himself would patrol, but the folks he supervised, he also instructed to patrol the lot on a daily basis.
I see. Okay.
But the patrolling of the lot, are you claiming that's operational? Is that
the
discretionary?
Your Honor, the patrolling of the lot itself would be an operational decision, but the decision as to how to modify their security measures was the planning level decision. And so those decisions...
There's a camera or not a camera. I mean, that's not going to stop necessarily anyone from... The camera in isolation isn't going to stop anyone from stealing something.
I believe cameras are perceived to be a deterrent, which is why they're used. So it's
but
these higher level
information, though, that this camera was in here prior to the time that the property was stolen.
Can you repeat? I missed the beginning of your question.
Is there anything in the record that indicates that the camera was in there in the lot at the time this property was stolen?
I believe that Lieutenant Skelton's affidavit, which is in the addendum, references adding a camera after the first break-in. And so I think that there had been one camera on site prior to the first break-in, then another camera was added, and then Mr. Elvin's vehicle was broken into at that point.
Ms. Anstead, I want to follow up just a little bit, Judge Hooten's initial questions regarding the statute. And it at least does beg the question of whether the whole immunity applies when the whole purpose of the immunity, as I understand it broadly from the case law that you've cited, is to avoid the concern a decision maker might have when having to exercise discretion to make a decision for which people might disagree with in a broad sense. But the legislature has affirmatively obligated your client to reasonably store the property. And it would seem like, as Judge Hooten says, that's almost inherently a factual issue for which if you have immunity, we'll never get to the facts of whether it's reasonable or not. But the legislature's affirmatively, the same legislature that created the statutory immunity as well. And I'm not quite understanding your distinction of that. You talked about it at the beginning. So your point, I guess, being there could be no immunity if there's some unreasonableness at the beginning of the point the car is brought into an impound lot. So for instance, let's say there's no gates around it and it's just our lot and they forget to lock the doors, but they bring it there. Someone opens up, takes the property. Is your point there, the immunity would not apply, but here, because it was something subsequent to the initial reasonable location of the property, that's a line is drawn there. So no longer, if you follow my question, is that what your explanation?
Yes, Your Honor. I think what you're getting at, and I agree with you, that there's sort of a temporal line that's drawn between the statutory requirement to reasonably secure the vehicle under the forfeiture statutes. And then here, the break-in occurs many months after that reasonably secure measures were taken. And so it's the intervening time and actions of the county thereafter, once we've satisfied that statutory obligation to secure the vehicle, any other actions we've taken are protected by that statutory immunity, given that change of time and circumstances with the break-in.
So I just want to make sure I understand what you're saying. Okay. The reason that the county would raise all this information or submit all this information about we had chain link fences, we had cameras, we had patrols, is to show that you made a diligent effort, right, to secure this, correct?
Not knowing precisely what Mr. Elvin's complaint about the county was.
Yes, but the reason you do all that is to secure this property.
Correct.
All right. And I don't know how you enforce this statute and how you deal with the statute without allowing all that information in as evidence as to whether you used reasonable diligence or not. Am I correct? Because otherwise you're just basically gutting the statute.
I agree with you, Your Honor, that information is relevant to the question of 609.5315, the security of the vehicle at the time of the seizure for forfeiture.
Okay. But now what I hear you arguing is that once they locked the car, they were done under the statute. And that all this other evidence is totally for something different. I'm not sure how you get, I don't know that the initial, I don't think there's an end time in the statute. In fact, if you read the statute, it seems to be as long as that property is in the possession of the agency, they have this obligation. So I'm not sure that you can draw that temporal line that you want us to draw here. And then what is clearly a duty under the statute becomes after they lock the car, then all of a sudden it magically becomes something within their official immunity range of discretionary conduct.
May I answer, Your Honor?
Yes, you may.
So it's sort of the evolution of this case and the clarification of the claim that is both the temporal change from, okay, the property is secured, it's in the lot, we've taken care of our obligations under the statute, to, okay, circumstances change, and now we're getting the claim that after the circumstances changed, the behavior of the county is somehow unreasonable. And I see that as an entirely separate issue.
All of that is based on your assumption that duty to avoid waste and that duty to secure and avoid waste of this property ended the minute they locked those doors. that
I wouldn't agree with that. I think what I'm saying is that I see it as almost the duty stepped up to another level once the first break-in happened. And so once we've satisfied that main responsibility, but then there was a break-in of the lot. And so perhaps there's an issue there. And then we have a next level of responsibility to further secure the lot. And that's where I think the immunity comes in. So we're asking the court to reverse the decision of the trial court and grant St. Louis County immunity, both vicarious official immunity and statutory discretionary immunity.
I have a question about vicarious official immunity, if Judge Sleater will allow.
Yes, indeed, I will.
Would you agree, Ms. Sandstead, that it's not automatic for the employer or the county, even if we assume that the employee would qualify as an individual? Would you agree?
I agree, Your Honor. It is more nuanced than that. However, our brief goes through the analysis that given the actions of the individual employees here that would be immune, there isn't any reason that it wouldn't follow in this case that the county would be vicariously immune as well.
Well, the Supreme Court sometimes draws a distinction by saying that anyway, while an individual may be blameless given his or her position, to extend immunity to the employer, to the governmental entity might give perverse incentives to in other words, an employer that was inactive when it should have been active and trying to prevent a harm, might then be rewarded by for its inactivity simply because the individual was fulfilling his or her duties. I think Slutton is a case that says that, but it seems like that reasoning might fit here. Now that we're just thinking about official immunity, I mean, even if the individuals involved would be immune, perhaps the county is not because it didn't take more urgent action to, on a larger scale, to prevent this from happening.
I think, Your Honor, that given that the actions here were taken affirmatively by county officials, this wasn't a case where the individual action would be entitled to immunity and there was, essentially a neglect or a non-action, a discretionary, what we might consider a mistake on the part of the employee. That is not the case here. We have a case where we have reasonable affirmative actions taken by the employee. And so I don't think this is a case where it follows that the county should not be able to benefit from that vicarious official immunity, given that the county took further steps to secure property. I don't think that it would be a good public policy to eliminate that protection for the county when it is a benefit to the employee in a situation like this.
Any other questions? Very good. Ms. Sandstead, well, it turned out you ended up with a rebuttal plus and answering our questions. We appreciate that. And perhaps you weren't ready for that, but you answered well. So it appeared you did well in that regard. Thank you for your answers. Thank you for your briefing. We will take the matter under advisement and issue an order accordingly.